the essence of the learning crisis is we have a bunch of kids who have been schooled, but not educated.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Originating at the London School of Economics, the new book, The London Consensus, is a large and very comprehensive successor to The Washington Consensus, the previous generation's agenda that informed development policy for a long time. It attempts to capture where the Washington Consensus fell short and to guide this generation of policymakers, well, maybe so we don't repeat some of the mistakes. Recently, we spoke to Ben Piper of the Gates Foundation on how we can do a better job of teaching children to read. But that's just one aspect of what is now widely accepted as a learning crisis in schools in low and middle income countries. Lant Pritchett's chapter in the London Consensus examines that crisis and suggests what policy can do to solve it. Lant, welcome back to Vox Dev Talks. Nice to talk to you again.
Always a pleasure to be here.
Lant, if Washington Consensus policy, if I can summarize it as get a lot more children into education, we can say that on those terms, it's worked pretty well.
Yes and no, because the starting point is we have to distinguish between school and education.
Uh-huh.
School is a means. Education is an outcome. Education should mean that you've actually learned something, whereas school can be defined as just time served. And there's only two phenomena we define on time served, school and prison. And so we have been phenomenally successful in the world over time in getting kids into school. That's for sure. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the problems with the Washington Consensus is that it bought into the idea that spend on school and invest in human capital were the same thing. And it turns out they're radically different things. You can spend a lot on school and not, in fact, create that much useful human capital.
Looking back at this, did most policymakers at the time, in the 80s, early 90s, did they assume that building schools, getting children to go to those schools, would solve the problem of learning poverty? You note in your chapter as well that this sort of measure, the quantity of schooling, was included in the Millennium Development Goals.
Yeah, but the Millennium Development Goals were stupid in a way that the Washington Consensus was stupid. It attempted to reduce the complex phenomena of development, which is this overarching fourfold transformation of countries to be more productive, countries to have higher state capability, countries to have more responsive states, countries to be more equal treatment of people, just that's what I mean by development, to a bunch of narrow, measurable, easy to describe targets. So by the time the MDGs declared completion of the universal primary school as a target, it was irrelevant for most developing countries. They had already done it. Like, what did that have to say to Latin America? Most Latin American countries, many Asian countries were very near complete. So the MDG and the Washington Consensus were mirror images of stupidity, of reductionist thinking. But I think everyone recognized that schooling was a necessary condition for education, for creating human capital. Mm-hmm. And again, I take a very broad view of what I mean by the education. I mean, children should emerge from their schooling experience adequately prepared for their lives as adults in their society, which includes being economically productive, includes being a parent, potentially includes being a citizen. So if you take the broad view that schooling is about preparing youth for the societies they live in, schooling was considered and is considered and is rightly considered a necessary condition, but the elision that it's a sufficient condition was the problem. I'm not quite sure what people did understand, but I think even by 1990, and I cite this in the chapter, there was a big conference of educationists, you know, not economists, educationists, and they were really clear that you both needed every kid in school, but that needed to lead to a quality education. The easy half of that is the logistical task of building out the system. Buildings, we can do that. We can reduce that to a plan that was amenable to a accumulationist development mentality, that what we lacked was these physical assets like schools. But what we've learned over time is that the physical assets need to be matched with a way in which those assets are used as productive. It took us longer than it should to get off the assumption that schooling was necessary and sufficient, and recognize that the essence of the learning crisis is we have a bunch of kids who have been schooled, but not educated.
In many policy discussions, you still see that assumption that the building more, providing more schools will move us forward. And to be clear, you're saying this policy has now run into a wall. It's completely run out of steam.
Well, it's run out of space kind of in a good way in lots of places. So in the 1960s, nearly every kid without an education lacked schooling. And so obviously building out schools made a ton of sense. In the chapter, I quote these numbers from a nice paper by Gus, Tanushek, and Wossman that shows how many kids are reaching the now SDG of some adequate actual learning measure. And they show that nearly all of the lack of education in the world today is lack of having been educated, even though you were and stayed in school till age 15. And the key thing that connects schooling and education is what I call a learning profile, which is if we measure on a vertical axis your education and on a horizontal axis time served in school, how steep is that curve? And in most countries, that learning profile is just so low that you'd have to stay in school till you were 50. You're exactly right. When you say we've run out of room, really the only way that you can produce more kids that are educated is to steepen the learning profile, which means kids get more of the skills, competencies, capabilities they need per year of schooling.
What are these skills and competencies that we are trying to create?
The skills and competencies we're trying to create is the ability to apply knowledge to situations that you're going to encounter. And this is super important because a lot of what I emphasize and what a learning crisis is about is what we call foundational learning. And what we mean by foundational learning is that you have actually grasped the concepts in such a way that you can apply them to unique and novel situations.
Uh-huh.
Just look at arithmetic, right? Can I teach you that 2 plus 2 equals 4 and 2 plus 3 equals 5? But moreover, can I teach you so that when you encounter a situation in which knowing how to do that arithmetic is useful, you see that this is a situation to which your skill should be applied? Schooling, first of all, you just memorized a bunch of things. But even if you've memorized a bunch of things and I give you a pen and paper exam that has questions posed in exactly the way you saw it in your textbook, and you can reproduce that correct answer, that still hasn't equipped you with an adequate education because you don't know how to use that knowledge. A lot of time I talk about test scores, but I want to talk about test scores which, like the PISA exams, which have been done in the OECD, actually test your ability to apply knowledge to new and novel situations. So it's not memorization. When I say foundational learning, I don't mean the three R's in some old skill and drill and memorize stuff. That's part of the problem. That's part of the reason why kids aren't able to learn, is they're never really taught in a way that they gain conceptual mastery over what they're taught, and hence it's not an adequate foundation for future learning. Let me give you one good example, right?
Yeah.
So in India, just a country I happen to work on, but this is common, they teach you measurement by showing you in your textbook a picture of a ruler and a picture of a pencil. And the pencil is often oriented on zero on the rule, and the tip is on a number. And you're taught the length of the pencil is the number on the ruler. So if the tip is on 6. Now, here's the thing. If you show them a picture in which the pencil starts at 1 and goes to 6, the plural answer of Indian eighth graders is that it's 6 long, because they haven't understood that length was displacement And this organization that was emphasizing the difference between rote learning and conceptual mastery actually had a video where they're working with a kid and they put the pencil bottom on zero, tip on six, and they ask him how long the pencil is. And he says it's 6 centimeters. And then they move it so that the tip is on seven. Mm-hmm. And they say, how long is the pencil? And he says, 7. And they move it to 8. How long is the pencil? And he says, oh, it's 8. And they say, so the pencil's getting longer as I move it? And you can just see on the inside this kid's head, it's like the difference between knowledge he actually had, which is length is a displacement invariant property of an object. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't have said it like that, but he knew things don't get longer by moving them, with what he had been taught in school. Which is, length is where the tip of the object is.
It's the number on the ruler.
It's the number on the ruler.
Yeah.
And so instead of learning what length is in a relevant way, where you could apply it to a bunch of situations, like I don't have to put the object on zero to measure it, he had just learned that in school, length means this. And so he had some school knowledge, and it never translated into any practical knowledge, right? So I think this is really a very deep problem because everybody set up a curriculum and they set up a way of learning that was meant to convey skills, capabilities, competencies that you could apply to your life in the world. And yet it gradually got distorted to where you really weren't learning anything that you could apply.
In policy terms,
yes.
Is some of the problem that we have been measuring the things that are easiest to measure? The number of schools, the percentage of children at those schools, how long they stay. These are all statistics that are easy to report. The sorts of things you're talking about, they're perhaps more difficult to collect and to analyze.
Absolutely. They're more difficult to collect and they're more difficult to create because organizations love to do what's easy. And there's this deeper thing, state capability. Policy has to say the state should do things in a way that it actually accomplishes the objective. But the tendency is to focus on the things and doing things in the way that the state does them. James Scott has this very famous book, Seeing Like a State. When the state sets out to do things, and I think these are words that he created and used, but they're now popular. It wants to make things legible to the state. You know, it wants to reduce things to narrowly measured things, like numbers of school, like numbers of kids per class, like numbers of kids enrolled, number of kids completing eighth grade, and then even expanded to inputs, like number of kids with access to books. It's easy to measure. It's easy to accomplish. Because if you have defined your output as the availability of your input, and your input can be made available in the logistical ways most natural to public sector systems, then you've defined yourself into success. And that's lovely. That's lovely. We would all love to define ourselves into success. It's not just that real conceptual learning is harder to measure. It's also harder to accomplish. Sometimes teachers just don't know how to do it. And so measuring it in and of itself doesn't also solve the, how do I accomplish this objective? So there's two deep problems between the kind of mismatch between the way in which public sector organizations want to organize and see and structure the world and what's actually required for an education system to consistently and routinely produce effective learning.
Is this a global crisis? Is everybody doing it wrong?
Not everybody's doing it completely wrong. Part of this article grew out of my experience of spending 8 years as the head of a very large global research project called RISE, Research on Improving Education Systems. And one of the countries we studied was Vietnam. So Vietnam, with, you know, very low per student expenditures, produces the equivalent learning levels as the typical OECD country. This isn't that they've got their own rote measures of learning and kids are just memorizing stuff. Kids are able to demonstrate the same skills of application of knowledge that are demonstrated by OECD kids. So Vietnam is doing something right. And one of the things we looked at in the research was, is Vietnam distinctive on any input measure? And what we found was mostly no.
Oh.
And the great thing is, Vietnam participated in the Young Lives study that tracked kids from 2 to 5 up to 12 to 15. So it's a repeat panel study. And so we could actually show if you measured kids at 5 that were identical, and of course it had a very rich array of characteristics of these children, like malnutrition, like what they had been exposed to, and even some measures of pre-literate intelligence, although I hesitate to use that word because it's hot, but anyway. And then you measured their knowledge at 12. What you found is all of the difference between Vietnamese kids and Indian kids at 12 was the result of what they learned in school. It wasn't that there are these insults from malnutrition. They were equally poor places. And so kids at 5 were roughly identical. And at 12, they were radically different. But if you looked at the easily measured things about schools, that accounted for 0% of why Vietnamese kids learned more. So if you said, suppose we had equalized the measured inputs of India and Vietnam, how much of the gap would it have eliminated? And the answer was zero.
Now, the London Consensus is all about creating policies that work. Normally, when I discuss these things, I talk about particular interventions. Should we do this about books or teachers or attendance? Or something like that. From what I read in your chapter, you're aiming bigger. You advocate a system approach here. Now, what does a system approach mean?
You can think of the proximate determinants of learning. In order for a child to learn effectively, the following things need to happen, both in terms of inputs and in terms of pedagogy, in terms of relationship, teaching and learning practices. Those are proximate determinants. Then you have to think of the proximate determinants of the proximate determinants. Why does effective teaching and learning happen in Vietnamese schools in this school and not in that school? Or why is this teacher effective and not that teacher? The system approach is you have to think of the proximate determinants of the proximate determinants of the proximate determinants. What happens in a country such that it has a schooling system in which the proximate determinants of learning aren't the routine way in which the education system operates? That's what a system approach ultimately means. When people use the word intervention, they often assume that making available or not making available a proximate determinant is an achievable thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I can make sure every kid is in a school that has a girls' bathroom. I could design an intervention that moves these proximate determinants. What I have at least learned from near 3 decades of studying education systems is that that doesn't actually work to move the needle on learning.
Right.
And so you have to go slightly deeper and ask, well, what would I have to change about the system such that it cascaded down to where in the individual school, the reproduction of the proximate determinants that produced effective learning was the routine outcome, the endogenous outcome of the way in which the system operated. And I think that system approach is really necessary because, and this is a super important point that almost no one knows, which is if you look at Zambia versus Vietnam, Vietnam on a measure of learning, which is you take adult women and you can see if they can read, and then you take adult women with 5 years of schooling and ask, can a woman as an adult who got 5 years of schooling read a single sentence in any language of her choosing? Vietnam, that's nearly 100%. Nearly every person who finished schools in Vietnam can read. And in Zambia, it's like 20%. Now, here's the interesting fact that no one knew until 2 years ago when Justin Sandifor and some co-authors wrote this nice paper, which is that 50 years ago, that learning outcome was nearly identical in Zambia and Vietnam.
Hang on, that means Zambia's got worse.
Exactly. It got unbelievably worse. And in fact, in most of the countries in the developing world, the fraction of women, and we just use women because that's the sampling frame for the demographic and health surveys, but it's also true of men. In most of the countries in the developing world, you are less likely to be able to read as an adult from having completed 5 years of schooling now than 50 years ago.
Lance, are there no shortcuts?
There are things you can do, but there are no shortcuts. I think the things you can do often turn out to be effervescent. And by effervescent, I mean, if you take a soda and you shake it up, all these bubbles pop off the surface. It looks very dynamic. Like this soda is very dynamic because look at all the bubbles and these things are shooting off. But the level of the fluid hasn't changed at all. And eventually the effervescence goes away. So I worry that a lot of attempts to improve schooling produce effervescent success because they don't focus on changing the system. And if you have a system that has spent 50 years and has adapted itself to declining learning outcomes while expanding itself, and then say, I'm not going to understand why and how this system operates in a way that has allowed this to be its trajectory. I'm just going to peg on to this thing, this existing project or this existing approach. That's likely going to be effervescent. You might succeed in some schools, you might succeed in some places, but often it's not going to lead to a lasting dynamic reversal that the system gets better and better over time. There are interventions like teaching at the right level and that can work in situations, but unless you have a system that says we are searching for more and more ways of our system getting better and better at routinely producing effective teaching and learning that produces in the children the capabilities we need, unless the system is structured to actually look for and reward progress on that front, eventually that goes away. Either it's just a once-off level effect, or it's hard to get even that approach to stick in the system. So there really are no shortcuts. Are there ways to produce immediate success? Yes. Is that a shortcut to long-run success? No, because you cannot overstress how far behind these countries are. The target level on a PISA level, which is norm, so the average OECD student is 500. The SDG, the Sustainable Development Goal for Learning of a 15-year-old, is on the order of 420. When they did PISA-like in developing countries in Africa, in many countries, the elite students in public schools, so the kids in public school who were, you know, both socioeconomically elite, they were male, they were urban, their measure of socioeconomic background was in the 95th percentile, they were at 350.
Okay.
So the elite in the public system were radically below the minimum goal. So then if you say, what is it going to take for, and this is Zambia, Zambia was one of the countries in this sample, what is it going to take for Zambia to routinely get every kid to 420? There is no intervention by intervention approach. Like these interventions produce improvements of like 10 points, but you're not 10 points behind. You're 150 points behind. And if you're 150 points behind, you have to think, how do I create a system that's pressured to replicate and produce endogenously as a result of the operation of the system, continuous improvement? Because you need continuous improvement over a long time, and it's going to take a long time. There are shortcuts to improvement, but there are no shortcuts to the learning crisis.
That also means that you cannot just take what's happened in Vietnam, make a template out of it, and apply it. If only.
If only it were so easy. And I think that approach often leads to just postponing the hard changes you need to make. Part of the RISE study, Vietnam was a case study, and we had a political scientist look at why, in fact, was Vietnam successful. And you come back with, it was just a hard, messy struggle. It wasn't that they had some brilliant bureaucracy with a top-down plan that implemented that plan. They just created a struggle for success in which people cared about success, set up tensions from the top to the bottom, where parents and communities and the Communist Party as a vertically integrated thing could integrate and put pressure on the system to perform. And that system was often corrupt, that a system was often chaotic, but it was pressured to perform in a complex, messy way. Mm-hmm. And people always want to look at success and extract easily replicable lessons. But if you look at Vietnam, the only lesson is you have to create a system in which there's a struggle for performance. And that struggle is enabled both within the education sector, within local communities, between parents and schools, in ways that are consistent with how your society works. The Ministry of Education of Finland had to create a special office for the treatment of foreign visitors. They outperformed right. on the PISA.
Yep.
And so everybody wanted to send a study tour to Finland. If you go to Finland and try to extract from the Finnish experience lessons for Zambia, that's just never yeah. going to work. Success can learn lessons from other places, and there are important lessons from other places, but it has to be homegrown. And homegrown means it has to grow on the soil that you have.
In many countries in the developing world, the private sector has expanded enormously in education. There is an argument that this helps. If they outperform, they can set standards or maybe create some of that environment for learning. There is also the argument that they suck resources out of the sector. Where do you stand on this?
I think the private sector has mostly served as a channel of mitigation for individual parents rather than a true positive social and system-wide dynamic. Oftentimes, the private sector can do better than the existing public sector, but as a catalyst for change, often the private sector just comes in and does moderately better than the existing public sector, enough to attract students to pay tuition and fees for it. But if you haven't paired that with a dynamic for the private sector itself, it doesn't seem to, in and of itself, be an adequate agent of system-wide change, which isn't to say limiting the private sector is a good thing.
Yeah, it's just not answering the question.
It's just not answering the question. And by the way, in many cities in India, the public sector is just dead completely. A major problem in the state of Tamil Nadu in India is what to do with all this expensive real estate it owns for schools that are empty. At one point in many states of India, in urban areas, the private sector was like 70% of the education, but it was just remaining at a quality just high enough and better enough than the public sector to attract, but it wasn't creating an upward dynamic. I'm an economist. I'm a big fan of people having choices. So allowing parents to opt into private schools, I think, is mostly a good thing. You would think kids leaving the public sector for the private sector will create a pressure on the public sector to improve. But in India, that didn't work. They just abandoned it and in droves, and the public sector never said, gee, we really should get on the ball here.
Very often, it's NGOs who are very involved in improving the quality of education. It sounds to me like you're saying this role can only be performed by the state.
I actually think that is right, but maybe that's even not enough. Uh-huh. Meaning, the state is also embedded in a broader society. This has to be a societal thing. NGOs can play two very different roles. And I think the NGO playing the role of doing education better is radically less important than NGO playing a role of creating the pressures on the system society-wide.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at Pratham, which is a very famous NGO
yeah.
in India, who I'm good friends with the leaders of it because I admire them. Rukmini Banerjee is one of my heroes in the development space. They did two things. They created this teaching at the right level approach that recognized that kids weren't getting foundational learning and were just being pushed through the school. So they said, how can we go back and remediate the deficits in a way that can improve schooling? And that was more of a pedagogical approach and technique. But what they realized is that technique wasn't going to be adopted unless the state was pressured to improve performance. And so then they also created this very simple measure of student performance to demonstrate that kids weren't learning what you thought they were learning. There was no meaning to being a fourth grade student. Fourth grade did not describe an education level. It just described a time served level. And they spent a decade repeating this survey that I think in the long run, the NGO-driven technique of what works without seeing this as socially transformational wouldn't have been effective. It would have been effervescent. You know, you would have said, oh, look, in these NGO schools, we do this or that. But if, in fact, your learning outcomes are much, much worse than they were 50 years ago, this isn't the lack of knowing what to do.
Mm-hmm.
You could teach kids to read 50 years ago, and then you're not doing it as a routine outcome of the system now. That's not a technological knowledge of pedagogy problem. That's an organizational problem. So it isn't that we lack adequate knowledge. It's the system stopped doing what it did do before. You have to understand that that's going to be a very different way of improvement, and that NGOs can play a big role in a social transformation that recognizes that this education system needs to produce the competencies and capabilities children need to succeed.
No easy answers. That's kind of how I remember school, actually. Lance, thank you very much for talking about it.
My pleasure.
Lance's chapter in the London Consensus is called Addressing the Learning Crisis, an Emergent Consensus. And the full name of the book, it's The London Consensus, Economic Principles for the 21st Century. Editors Besley, Buccelli and Velasco. It is published by LSE Press. You can also get it as a free download. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. Best way to make sure you don't miss an episode. You know what I'm going to say by now. Subscribe. You find us wherever you get your podcasts. All our past episodes are at voxdev.org. You will also find articles about the topics we feature, many about education. If you like what you're hearing, please tell someone else about us and leave us a review. Vox Dev Talks is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber and our editor is Andrei Zargarian. Thanks to Oliver Hanni and Iman Siddiq at Vox Dev.